a good buddy of mine, he's a client also, Julian Robertson. We were a long time ago pulling around the no motor zone, and we pulled right, I was pulling fast to get across the bay, and we pulled right into a crocodile laying on the bottom that we never saw. The crocodile stood up, the boat was thrown in the air, the crocodile bit the boat and shook it. He put three holes in the wood hull, ripped the rub rail down in the bow, and my buddy Julian fell out of the boat and on the tail side of the crocodile. We had T-boned him and he fell onto the tail, and his legs got stuck in the mud. So he's trying to pull himself in, the crocodile shaking the boat and hissing. I'm on the pulling tower just trying to hang on. So Julian finally frees his legs, jumps in the boat, and tries to run back where I'm at and get on the pulling tower with me. So anyways, I backed up and the croc was pissed and we were a little shaken up, but everything worked out. We pulled over to the bank and inspected the boat, and we weren't going to sink, so we just kept fishing.
Hey guys, this is Hunter Levine, and thank you for listening to the Captain's Collective podcast, brought to you by Skinny Water Culture, Hell's Bay Boatworks, Orvis Fly Fishing, Traeger Grills, Turtle Box Audio, and Costa Sunglasses. Recently, on a trip to Miami, I got a chance to swing by and spend some time with Captain Brian Esposito, who focuses mostly on running saltwater and freshwater trips in the Florida Everglades. As we sat on Brian's back porch, surrounded by cardinals and some friendly, partially trained squirrels, Brian shared with me his journey into guiding and the ins and outs of the Florida Everglades, and how his days of surfing as a teen eventually led to him building and working on his own custom skiffs. Brian is a modern-day Gladesman who's dedicated his life to learning as much as he can about these amazing waters, from scouting for fish to planning camping trips. Brian gives some great insight during this conversation. We hope that you enjoy. This is the Captain's Collective.
I'll say it's anything you choose, I think it picks you, you know, it's genetic.
Let everything else stop in the world and just be quiet. And it's amazing where your mind goes at that point and where it doesn't go. And sometimes just that quiet space is what we need, and especially in this day and age.
If you have a fly rod in your hand, it's this tool that takes you to beautiful places. You meet hopefully wonderful people, and it's just this cherry on top of this outdoor adventure.
When the fish is coming, that shot within a shot, that timer starts. Beep, 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 beep,
beep, beep, beep. No one else knew anything anyway, and you just definitely making it up as you're going along. But
so what Grandpa and Dad would tell me is like, all right, where's the old big trout laying out there? Where's his shaving cream on the water? Where's he been shaving this morning? So look for his shaving cream on the water, and that's where he's going to be.
Well, hey, Brian, it's great to have you on the podcast. What a beautiful day, just kind of hanging out here in your backyard. You got your squirrels and your blue jays. It's a beautiful day. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, welcome here to our home, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, I want to hear all about your kind of story of how you got into guiding, because I've had a lot of people over the past 2 years kind of point me your way and say, you need to interview Brian, you need to interview Brian. I'd love just to hear about, for you, like kind of how you got into guiding and where it all began.
Okay. So I had a small boat company called Gladescraft. The economy was tanking around 08-09, and I had to do something. And all my friends are fishing guides. I used to always fish with them on my days off, and they kind of called me the guide's guide. Some of them would joke around and say that. And so I just fell right into it. You know, had a few good friends that helped me with, you know, gave me overflow to start, and shared clients with me. I got a real fast start.
Yeah. How did you get into boat building? Because that's not like a, you know, when you're at a high school career fair, they're not normally saying, yeah, and you could build boats, you know.
Hey, kill brain cells. No, but okay, so we all grew up, my friends and I, surfing and fishing. So we were always fixing our surfboards.
Yeah.
So we learned how to work with the foam and the cloth and the resin, all the components, pretty early on, and grind and sand and stuff. So
how old was that?
You know, teenage years, you know, and, you know, stuff
right
like
here
that.
In Hollywood? Or
yeah, I grew up in Deerfield. So okay, we'd surf up coast, you know, above Jupiter where the swells hit better, or, you know, the wind chops down south here. So you can surf quite a bit if you have the time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not Hawaii, but get out there. So anyways, so the the fiberglass stuff. I had a little background how to work with that. And then there's Merritt Boatyard in Pompano, and I had some friends that worked there. So they were, you know, doing pretty advanced stuff, building big boats, painting, and all, you know, fairing and doing all the stuff you got to do when you build boats. And kind of a guy that worked there and I built a boat.
Okay.
And kind of learned like that.
Yeah, yeah. And as a kid, did you do a lot of, I mean, obviously you did, you know, surfing, but did you do a lot of fishing as well, kind of in the area, or when did that play in?
Yeah, I always fished my whole life since I was a little kid. My dad, I'd go with my dad or his friends. Mm. And we, you know, mountain streams in North Carolina, or bass fishing in the neighborhood lakes. That was a big deal. You know, and I could ride my bike to the intercoastal and the canals and bridges around the house. And my mom would take me to the pier, and I'd buy shrimp, get like five dozen shrimp, put them in a bucket. She'd drop me off, and at the bridge around the corner, and I'd catch something on every one of those five dozen shrimp back then. Little snooks, snappers, jacks, everything lived under there. Every single shrimp got bit as soon as it hit the water. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, so tell me more about, okay, the, you know, obviously there was the crash in the economy. Mm-hmm. You're building boats, and you're like, man, I want to get into guiding. Because it's interesting to me, because it's like, that's not the most considered the most stable, you know, stable job. So it's interesting, like that shift. What did that look like?
You know, so I probably made the transition easier than most people because I have great friends that helped me out.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Hurstead, Andy Thompson, people like that. Just, mm-hmm. you know, very generous, shared clients. I got on some tournament scenes, some charity tournaments, and you meet a lot of clients that way real fast. And then, you know, just word of mouth and do your best and try to build your business. And
yeah, no, I think that's, you know, that's really neat too, just to kind of hear about a lot of the guys that I've hung out with around the East Coast, mm-hmm. that surfing aspect of things, not so much in the Gulf.
The right coast.
Yeah, the right coast. But, you know, it's kind of cool to hear just about how learning to work with the surfboard materials kind of led to you being able to work with skiffs. I mean, for you, what is the significance in being able to build your own boats? And I would imagine you can better understand boats and how to use them, but how does that kind of work out?
All right, so for me, building boats, I've always been real creative, so that was a huge creative outlet. And it's really fun to see what hull dimensions make the boat do what, and hull shapes. And also, when you build your own skiffs, you can really cheat. You can cheat a million different ways. You can really make the boat much, much lighter than a production boat.
Because
all these production companies or boat companies they're so handicapped working with the public, because the public is so mean.
Yeah.
You know, the boat can't break, nothing can happen, or they got to fix it. And also, they get blasted on social media. They get, you know, hammered for any little thing that happens. So build them for yourself, basically. Okay, so boat companies make a huge safety factor, and the boats are way heavier than they might have to be.
Yeah.
But you can cheat a lot, build them for yourself, and just make them like glorified surfboards, really. And they pressure ding and stuff, or drop pliers. They might get a little gouge, but every few months I put a little putty in paint, and the boat's far lighter and more responsive than most things you can buy.
Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of people in fly fishing, they have that satisfaction of tying their own fly and catching a fish with the fly. And I mean, you just take that to the next level if you've hand built a skiff or a canoe or you know, a surfboard that has gunnels.
Bigger, more expensive, time consuming learning curve and hobby.
Yeah,
but it's cool. You make canoes, even you figure out what dimensions work. You know, does a 40 inch bottom, you know, it's more stable, but you can't paddle it as fast, or you know how the boat, too short a boat doesn't seem to work good. Boats have to be at least, you know, 15, 16 feet long. Little 12 and 13 foot boats don't work. It's just not enough boat, you know? It seems like it would, but it's not, because people weigh a certain amount, and wave, you know, you have to span waves. Waves are a certain size. And so I'm a fan of, like, you know, 16, 18 foot boats, like most people, but nothing shorter. And narrow is fine, because the boat really doesn't know how long it is under power, whether you're pulling it or the motor, but it knows how wide it is, because it's got to push through the water, all that width. So, you know, the longer narrow boat works great, especially when you got to pull miles and miles, like in the Everglades sometimes.
Yeah, and that's, you know, kind of your home base, right? Everglades is where you're doing most of your guiding out of. Tell me about how you like to fish the Everglades. And really, we, believe it or not, on this podcast, we haven't talked much about the Everglades. So I'd love just to hear about kind of your style of fishing there.
Oh, cool. Well, it's, I forget, maybe 1.2 or 3 million acres of the way it was. It's right there, you know, behind Miami. And it's like going back in time. There's no condos, no jet skis, no, you know, even on the busiest holiday weekends, I can go out and get lost and not see another boat or hear one for days.
Wow.
Because there's so much country. It's, you know, many lifetimes to see it all once. Every little pond and nook and cranny.
Yeah. And so what type of, you know, setup are you bringing out there? Because I know you try to keep things really simple and efficient. Like when a typical day in the Everglades, what's the setup look like? Boat gear?
Yeah. Typical day. You know, I fish out of a Spear Boatworks Everglades boat most of the time, just because it gets so shallow. Mm-hmm. And there's no limits. It still covers water fast, rides soft enough for the people to be comfortable. I can tarpon fish all the park waters. It never gets that rough there out of it. Mm-hmm. I have no limits. I can pull in 6 inches of water, go tarpon fishing, get around fast. You know, for my fly guys or spin guys, I fish both all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really like no limits, I'd say, with that boat.
Out of all the different kind of things in the Everglades, what do you enjoy targeting the most?
All right, so my favorite fish is snook. In the process of snook fishing, it always has been since I was a kid. There's so many fish to fish for in the Everglades, though. You know, and it's surprisingly, it's going to sound weird, but I love fishing for largemouth bass.
Mm-hmm.
It's something about, they're just a different snook.
Yeah, yeah. That was something that I was talking to Harry's son, Luke, and I was like, what do you think I should ask Brian? He's like, man, ask him what's his draw to the bass. Give us, because a lot of guys on the show, they like bass fishing because of what it meant in their story, because for a lot of people, it was the first fish they fell in love with because they were a kid and they could go to a pond. But for you, you've kind of maintained that love where you don't see a lot of saltwater guys spending much time and really, you know, advocating for the bass. What about it draws you?
Yeah, the bass is cool. He's real honest and smart, but, you know, willingly bite. So he's very readily available. And the pace of the bass fishing I really like. It's just relax, cast, and feel the equipment, feel the rod, load, cast, whether it's a spin rod, fly rod. Plenty of bass down here. You get lots of bites, you know, tons of bites. If you're looking for just stay busy in action, it's all, you know, usually very consistent all day. And also, with the bass, they're a great bad weather bailout plan. Like so many times in the spring, the guys come to catch tarpon and it's really blowing and it's raining, but that's the best day to bass fish. So we could either go catch no tarpon or 100 bass. And now the peacocks have come on real strong. So we've got that whole fishery here.
How do you decide, like, on any given day, okay, you're going to the Everglades, what does that thought process look like on deciding what you're going to target and where you're going to go? Because there's so much.
Yeah.
You talked about how the scale, and when you look at a map, you can just see it's like, man, this is a huge, huge diverse fishery. How does the thought process work?
Yeah, so I always try to work with the conditions, not against them. And, you know, different conditions, you know, make different species more available. I just try to, you know, some guys get hung up on the species, but I try to roll with what the day's giving you, with the wind direction and the sky and the fish that might be available on that day more than others. So basically I work with the conditions, try to sight fish if that's what the people want to do. But a lot of, you know, sometimes you have to blind cast all day, and that's fine there because that's a great option. Like sometimes in the clear water fisheries for the bonefish and the permit, if it's cloudy, you know, and in high tide especially, you got to go home, or, you know, just have a brutally boring day.
If you were, you know, talking to somebody who never fished the Everglades before, and they came to you and they said, Brian, I want to fish it right. I want to do it the right way. What's the right way for that fishery?
Well, try to see as much as you can, as fast as you can, as many times as you can see it, because it's always changing, even year to year. And every 5 years, it's a whole different place. Nothing stays the same for too long. Fish do this for 5 years, do that for 5 years. Right now, we're blessed to have just a really good fish population, but maybe 8 years ago, it was pretty bleak. So everything comes and goes. It's always cyclical there. The freezes seem to take the fish, and the hurricanes make the fish. 100%. So we're coming off of Irma right now, 3-4 years later.
Yeah.
We've got lots of snook and redfish and baby tarpon, triple tail.
Why do you think that is? What's the thought process? I know the freeze. How does the hurricane come in and play, you think?
Well, the biologists say that the storm surges help the larva get way back in the little ponds and way back in the mangroves where it needs to start its life. And it just facilitates it getting there, and just a lot more of it gets there, I guess, good survivorship of that year class. And then they start growing up and doing their thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, with kind of wanting to do it right too, like a light boat,
Yeah.
Try to pull as much as you can. I mean,
and have as many tools as you can. So I've got three different boats. I've got Hell's Bay Biscayne, which is great for, you know, anything big water, general purpose boats. Great. Just doesn't get super shallow. Then I've got the Spear Everglades, which gets extremely shallow, and I can do anything in that thing. Then I've got another little homemade boat that's kind of like a Ginu maybe, but canoe skiff hybrid.
Yeah.
No pulling tower, and it's 17 feet long, but only maybe 48 inches wide on the top side. And it fits up every creek, and I can drag it over the land if I have to. That thing, it's four-wheel drive, no limits in that thing.
Yeah.
I can get out of bounds, basically.
Do you see a lot of mistakes that, like, young captains, young anglers make when going to the Everglades that you could help kind of cut a little bit of the learning curve? Obviously, they got to figure out the layout themselves. Like,
yeah.
But what are just some, like, man, don't do that. Let me go ahead and help you out here.
Yeah, learn it for yourself. That's the most rewarding anyways. But basically, don't come in hot. Like, you should always, I always think you should idle for 5 minutes and then pull for 5 minutes and then fish a shoreline. If you run right up there, wake it, start pulling, banging around, stripping out line, it's over before it started. You know, the fish mostly leave, especially the big ones, and the ones that are left there aren't going to bite that good. So take 5 minutes to idle, take 5 minutes to pull, and the same thing leaving. Like, if you think the fish aren't there, don't just jump up on the shoreline and run away,
because
there probably were tons of fish there, like you thought, you know. And, you know, take 5 minutes to pull out and then idle for another two or three and then run.
Yeah.
You know, and that's better for everybody, not just you. And the fish especially, they got to win more than anybody. So.
And with that stealth, like, that's a big part of, obviously, how you fish in the Everglades. I mean, what are some other tips you could give on just helping people increase their stealthiness?
Pull very slow. You know, even if you think you're pulling slow, pull slower. You know, those fish feel everything. Even when you're in a canoe, you know, and you're barely displacing water, they feel. You know, watch the mullet spooking 200 feet away. The mullet spook first, but the other fish feel you the same. They just put up with you more.
Yeah.
You know, just go slow. Don't shake when you cast. Don't, you know, just be as quiet as you can on the boat. Don't bang things, drop things, you know.
Is that tough with, like, just because of how technical that fishery is with clients who maybe have never fished it before? Like, is there anything that you do or any ways that you try to help them prepare for that fishery?
Just drop the push pull in their head now and then when they're making two. No, just kidding. But no. You know, just learn as you go, and they pick it up pretty quick. They see right away what they'll have success or failure, and they seem pretty, you know, they want to succeed, and it'll click, and they'll be quieter. Or, you know, a lot of people aren't, you know, they're older or not physically able to do things, and they're going to make more commotion in the boat. That's fine. Just what it is, you know.
With all the options around you, what is the draw for you just to keep kind of focusing more and more and more on the Everglades rather than trying to spend a large amount of time in the Keys or a large amount of time in Louisiana? I mean, for you, what's so special about it?
It's just, you're always peeling back the layers till, like, the day you quit fishing there. You'll never totally know it, and it's always changing. So, and I learn every year. Like, and sometimes I'm like, I don't even know how I did it last year, because I feel like I know so much more this year.
Yeah.
And just peel the layers back and just be observant, and why did this work, and what else is like this that might work the same way or the same conditions, or, you know. And network with a couple buddies, that helps a lot, you know, because you can't see everything every day. You know, don't talk to the whole world, but it's good to have a little network. That helps too.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you one of the guys who just keeps everything in your head, or do you write stuff down? I mean, anything on that front?
I keep it all in my head. I used to keep a log of all my snook catches when I was younger, until maybe I was 30, say, maybe 25. And I was up to like 20,000. And I quit, you know. I still have the list somewhere, but not, you know, but no, just keep it in my head, whether that's good or bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you had written something on the website. I wrote it down because I thought it was really good. You said, it's been my life's work to learn every nook and cranny of this vast ecosystem. What is there a systematic approach, or what does it look like to try to really learn an ecosystem? Like, is there a systematic approach? Is it just obviously time on the water? I mean,
yeah, and a lot of gut feeling or what's worked in the past. You know, at certain times of the year, I'm trying to just find very remote spots as far up creek and bay systems as I can get into the fresh water. And then sometimes I'm in the wide open flats, and there's so many nuances to the even a giant wide open flat. There's so many ridges and lakes, and you know, different things to make the fish do what they do. And, you know, temperature and drought, both like cold temperature and drought seem to put fish in similar spots, you know, because the cold makes them run to the deeper areas. And so a little bit deeper areas, not deep.
Yeah.
And then drought too, that'll put them in the deeper areas. So like in the backcountry areas that hold snook and will hold them good in drought and cold conditions, same spots.
What's like when you think about somebody who, you know, is a really, really great, you know, waterman from Everglades, in like the kind of generation maybe that's came before you, like what kind of inspires you or draws you to that?
To the guys that came before me?
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up watching Walker's K like everybody, you know, and you see how they do it, and that just accelerates your learning curve because you're seeing, you know.
I'm
a real visual learner, not just spots, but just techniques and how they move and how they do things and talk and, you know, the whole deal. And I mean, I've got a lot of respect for all the guys that came before me. They knew a lot, and there was a lot more fish, maybe not. I'm sure there were.
Yeah.
But I mean, they definitely paved a road.
Yeah, for sure. I was curious just because, I mean, you know, everybody that I interview has people that come before them that kind of shape them, and then they're turning around and passing it to the next generation. I mean, for you, when you first really began learning the Everglades, was there somebody who really helped you through that process, like a mentor?
So my dad would take me there, but he didn't really pull. We had a bass boat, we'd trolling motor around a little bit, and then some of his buddies had saltwater boats, but we still didn't pull. So it wasn't until I could get down there with my buddies at the time and start pulling around our little John boats that we had. We could start to drive, you know, at 16, had a little Ford little SUV that could tow a John boat. We'd start going over there way too much. We were always, you know, over there way more than we should have been.
Yeah.
And just trying to learn stuff.
Yeah, I just interviewed a guy down in Miami, Willie, and he got his dad when he turned 16. His dad's like, "You want a car or you want a skiff?" And he's like, "I want a skiff," you know?
Yeah.
He loved fishing. And just kind of as a very similar story to you in the sense of just grew up in that fishery and still fishes it type thing.
Yeah.
For you, when you look back at those years, like in what way did being, you know, 16, 17 years old with a John boat running around, you know, the Everglades, how did that shape you into the guide that you are today?
I mean, that was freedom there. You know, you're young and you have a boat and you're just unlimited energy. You can fish till dark every day and, you know, see a lot of things, learn fast. You're like a sponge absorbing. And just that much, you know, years and years in that same area, seeing that all the areas change and over time, and just seeing how that, just staying current with everything. And that's a lot of it, just staying current, because one shoreline might fish good for 5 years, might not fish good for 5 years, and then fish is good again for 5 years. And it's just time in the water is the main thing, I guess. Being observant.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a really great gift to be able to have parents who are supportive in those years and, you know, kind of letting kids go out and explore. And some of that, I think, gets lost in today's world, where I think we have some access to so much information. Every time a boat gets in an accident, every time somebody goes missing, you know, we all know about it.
Yeah.
And it makes parents more paranoid. And
yeah, we had the paper charts. It was a really big deal when the first standard mapping satellite charts came out, because then we're like, oh, all that's back there. Wow, let's try to get in that. And then we'd, you know, be working our way back into areas, putting the pen, keeping the pen on the map where we are at the time, like a pen point, you know, and if it rolled around, then you're lost. And you know, these new GPSs are great. They really let you explore with like you're driving around on Google Earth like a video game.
Yeah.
But, with the John boat and the old paper charts, we got into some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. Is there, I mean, what's, you know, I've heard a lot of guys who are older who grew up fishing that way, you know, talk about obviously the GPS can become a crutch and you don't learn how to read water or explore. I mean, for you, like, if you were making an argument to somebody that, hey, it's actually really good for you to remove the technology aspect, what are they going to get from that?
I mean, if you remove the technology, I mean, I think it heightens your senses a little bit, but if you don't totally lean on it, you know, I think it's a good tool. There's nothing wrong with the GPS, with the good mapping. And there's things I fish now that I would never have found or had the courage to go into without that, you know, as long as you know, it is what it is. And it's not going to go away. So everyone else has got it. So you might as well learn how to use it, you know, and use it to your advantage. And, It makes your world a lot bigger. But still, don't totally rely on it and unplug at the same time, and use your senses, you know, and your instincts out there.
Yeah, is you know, you were talking about instincts, like developing instincts. When you look back, were there some mistakes that you made when you were exploring it? Like, I would imagine you've been lost a time or two, and anything get a little sketchy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like the old John boats used to slide out in the turns, and you'd slide up on a mud bank with maybe some low mangrove roots and pretty stuck. I remember having to rip the hatches off the John boat one time to stand on them in the mud to get enough traction to pull the boat back in the water because the mud was so soft.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to destroy the boat halfway to get it out of
like
the, off the mud bank. Yeah,
mud
exactly.
Shoes.
With big, it was old plywood John boat hatches with indoor outdoor carpet.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
What else for you, like, when, you know, that you felt like just really important things? I would imagine safety gear, you know, being so remote. I mean, you have cell service, like.
Yeah, sometimes you have cell service. Nowadays, I carry one of those InReaches, and I make sure it's always charged and test it now and then. And that's, you know, and I always, if I'm going to do something really weird and go far and way back into something, I'll tell some of my good fishing buddies, like, hey, I'm going to be here, more or less, make sure I come out. And so, you know, that kind of float plan and the InReach, you know, the handhelds are pretty much useless. There's no one there to listen to you. They don't go that far. Cell phones kind of work in some areas, but
yeah.
So that's what I do. I always carry enough water. If we get stuck, I'll be good for the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And also I carry some small emergency blankets that fold up. They're $5. They fold up to like a wallet size,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially in the winter, because hypothermia can be a big deal if you get stuck overnight somewhere and it rains on you or whatever, a front comes through.
Yeah, no, that's
that's
all good stuff. I don't think I have any blankets. I definitely have, you know, first aid kit and definitely the water pieces.
Mm-hmm.
That's a no-brainer, I feel like.
But. And in the summer, I bring a big 7-foot umbrella I can put up in the rod holder. If people are getting overheated or if we get stranded, you don't want to dive exposure out there, whether it's cold or too much or heat stroke. So, you know, try to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. If it's good with you, I'd love to go into some what I call random fire questions.
Yeah,
just some different stuff that that I have here. So one of them is, I love to ask people what makes somebody a great guide.
You know, it's the client's day, not yours. You got to remember that. You got to be patient. You can never yell. You know, you never want a tense moment on the boat. And you know, everyone's different. You're not going to get along with everybody. You're going to get along famously with people. Just in hard work. I mean, you know, hard work, try your hardest. And then at the end of the day, you know, you had a good time, and whether you caught fish or not, and you learned something, or they saw something. And the clients don't always have to catch as many fish as you think to have a great day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's easy to forget, because with guides, they're out there every single day. So they have this huge scope of comparison.
Yeah.
You know, like 2 weeks ago, they know that they did X, Y, Z. And the client, you know, he's just really excited to have caught a really big snook. He's never caught one before. And so, I mean, I think that's really good advice. I mean, it's even with people who are fishing with kids, it's the same way. It's like, you know, what I think is a good day and what my daughter thinks is a good day are two different things. And, if my daughter's happy fishing with her dad, it's a good day. But in my mind, you know, it's easy just to forget that.
And if it gets really slow, eat something. that always boosts morale.
Yeah. And if things are going really well, eat something.
Drink
something. Yeah.
Hey, take a minute.
we had the other day we were out and we were fishing Biscayne and everything, and we were like, okay, like, you know, like, I really want to catch, you know, a permit, my first like permit on a fly. And we had these like Coronas, and we're like, we're not drinking a Corona until you know, we do or whatever, and we put it in the boat and stuff. And like, it was like 3 p.m. I had like broke the hook on a permit, and we were like, oh, you know, and just had the beer sitting in there and stuff. And we were like, you know what, we just need to go ahead and just celebrate the hookup, you know,
thing,
you know. And it's, I think, I don't know. I mean, I think, like using food and being well prepared and, you know, drinking enough water. Like, I definitely have fished with people too, where, you know, they just get busy and they don't drink water, and then they start feeling like crap later in the day.
You have to manage your clients, you know, 'cause they're not used to that. And you got to know when they're going to be in trouble or not before they are. And, especially in a tournament, you got to make that guy last. You got to know when to tell him to eat, drink, sit down. You know, you got to kind of manage them, basically.
Yeah. How does the shifting from, you know, into a tournament for you, what does that process look like? Because everybody's a little different.
So I don't fish tons of tournaments. I did the Gold Cup for like 6 years with Dave Preston. He's a great angler, and he just won it actually last year. Yeah. You know, with a new guide, so that's like, but
that's like an awkward text message from him.
Yeah. Hey, man. But tournaments are fun, especially when you're doing good and the fishing's good. When the weather's bad, the fishing's bad, and you just have to go fish for tarpon, say, like in the Gold Cup. That's a grindy week. But if you're, you know, weather's good, fishing's good, it's fun. You know, and you're at a heightened level of kind of awareness and effort, and it's fun too to kind of bring it up to that level.
Yeah, and you talked about managing the client, like just helping remind them water, rest, that type of thing. But what does it look like to try to manage yourself? Because I know there's a lot of self-discipline and management that you put into what you do.
Yeah, so the time is like the one thing you can sort of control, right? So, you know, with the South Florida, the way the fishing works here, there's always drive time somewhere. So I limit the boat time to 8 hours. You have to, or you have no life. It's still going to be a 12-hour day at the end of it with driving and clean up and prep. And so I have to limit the time in the boat to 8 hours, you know, and to have a good home life and to actually have a life too. And that's enough. If you haven't caught them all in 8 hours, you know, you're probably not gonna, or, you know.
Yeah.
You've either had your fill, and if it's not good, you want to come in anyways.
Yeah. And that's like, I know somebody who's a owner operator of a Chick-fil-A, and he's like, if we can't get it done in 6 days, then we shouldn't be in business.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's obviously times where, you know, you're in a circumstance with friends or a certain place and you really want to grind it out and do something really big. But, you know, I think back to the client piece too. It's like, it's, you know, they're probably not used to being in the sun that long, on their feet that long, you know, depending on what they do for a living.
Yeah. And we have to sleep a lot too. 8 hours of sleep, super important. You know, if you get home and cleaned up, it's hour 12, 13, you got to go to sleep at hour 16. You got to really manage your time, you know, and have at least a few hours of home life. You know, to make it all work.
Yeah. For you, have you always been in really good shape and always taken that really serious?
Yeah. I try to, you know, work out somewhat. I mountain bike a lot when I can. And, you know, just maybe naturally blessed with metabolism. But I do try to stay healthy and very aware of if I get an ache and pain, I've got to rehab it before it turns into something big and then I can't work. So I'm all, you know, very aware of that.
And that, for me, like, it's, you know, a lot of the guys that I've met that have been shaped by surf culture seem like they're just in better shape.
Yeah, we grew up moving and breathing and paddling, and nothing gets you in shape like surfing, you know, the paddling and the breathing and, you know, all the stuff you got to do. And, you know, that's a great way to stay in shape.
Do you still surf a little bit? Or
not so much anymore since I had a shoulder operation. Yeah. I'm feeling good now, but I still don't do it. Plus, you know, no time, you know, you work so much, and then when you're not working, there's always something to do. And I moved a little more south where the waves aren't as good. So, yeah, basically not so much anymore, but I'd like to do it. You know, pick it back up again.
Yeah. What about camping? Do you ever do camping trips in the Everglades?
Yeah, I've camped a lot over time, you know, with my friends. And now sometimes I'll camp down there overnight just when I'm doing charters now and then, just to not drive back and forth and be able to put in a little more of a day. And especially when I go to the no motor zones and stuff, they're a bigger day. And, you know, it's hard to get all that done sometimes in 8 hours. So I'll definitely camp down there, and some of my buddies do it too. And, you know, it's nice.
If somebody wants to plan a camping trip, like, what's some things they need to consider and do?
Well, you can wilderness camp on the beaches or the Cheekies. You just definitely want to watch the weather. You don't want to be on the Cape Sable Beach in a cold front or a west wind. Lots of people's boats get buried. And you can also just keep it simple and camp at the Flamingo Marina or, you know, over by Chuck Lusky somewhere. You know, have a bathroom and a store and resources.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about the Cheekies, because that's something I haven't done that I'd like to do. It sounds and looks really cool. I mean, how do you do that well? Don't go out with a west wind. Don't sink your boat. Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah. Or the Cheekies, they're more in the bays where it's protected. Mm-hmm. But no dirt, no raccoons. That's cheeky camping. So you know, you're not supposed to nail to anything. So bring rope or twine to tie your tent down. But it's nice. You're in a little small spot. You can't roam around and range around on land like on the beach or at the campground, but it's neat. You're right there on the water. The boat's right at your feet, tied up all night. You can hear the waves lapping, and, you know, the porpoises come in at night and stuff, and the snook pop in the bushes behind you. It's really cool. The place kind of comes alive at night. We're never out there to see it, but it gets very loud at night sometimes, fish busting and moving. You know?
Yeah, I was curious if there was any night fishing in the Everglades. I mean, obviously you don't have lights and dock lights and stuff, but
yeah, I know there's probably a whole world of it, and then some people do it, but, you know, it just doesn't fit the guiding schedule. You got to keep a schedule.
Yeah,
and plus, it, you know, it's I just feel like a channel marker seeking missile at night. Like I you know, running around at night. You know, it's just, something's going to happen one day.
Well, I was also kind of curious on, like, you know, obviously Everglades is known for having a lot of insects.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What's the protocol there?
So in the half the year, the bugs are bad. Launch the boat as quick as you can. Don't even try to put on the bug spray in the parking lot because you're just prolonging everything. Mm-hmm. Just get out of the car, jump in the boat, and go. And then when you're on the water, there's really no bugs in the daytime, just the parking lot. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes you hook the mangroves, you go in to get your fly out, and then you're stuck with the bugs. You got to go run the boat to get rid of them.
Yeah.
You know, and come back or go somewhere else. And they can run the day a little bit, but it's usually not too bad.
Another question I had was, you know, as somebody who really likes to bass fish, what do you feel like saltwater guides could learn from the bass fishing world?
You know, the bass guys, when they get on the boat, they are so efficient and so fast and cover water so accurately and good. Like, they make a million casts a minute. You know, they're very disciplined. Mm. You know, they're really good casters. Bass guys, we're shoreline casting or sight fishing. If I hear I got a bass guy coming, he's going to be on the money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you've mentioned discipline a few times. How does being a really disciplined person play out in being an angler or a captain?
Well, you got to, you know, there's a lot of times when, like, nothing's happening. So you got to mentally overcome the slow times or boring times or, you know, lots of times learning most of the things aren't working out. You know, you got to just, you know, be patient, and maybe patience and discipline are sort of the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. I could definitely see that. Those being, at least, if not the same thing, very related with a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
With, you know, one of the things that's always interesting, like, when I've been around bass guys, is they're very, like, systematic in what they're doing when they're searching for fish. You know, they're really good at locating fish, even though they have all the technology to do so.
Oh, yeah, pattern fishing's huge, even in saltwater on the flats. And, you know, like, you know, if it's a little cool, a little hot, they're going to be a little this depth or that depth. Or, you know, sometimes everything's perfect. They're real shallow and they're tailing, or they want to be on a point with current. Or, you know, if it's cold, they want to be out of the current. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you're more in the coves. I'm trying to see when, if it's cold sight fishing, or, and in the summer, they're not going to be in that little shallow cove. They're going to be out on the point where there's current.
Yeah.
So you always want to make a pattern, basically.
When you're in an area, like, you know, I know that you recently took a trip to Homosassa, and it's like an area you're not as familiar with. How do you, like, try to systematically locate fish? I mean, without, I guess, giving away too much black magic.
I mean, I have an idea what the place looks like by looking at a map ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Especially over there, idle and idle and idle. Just trim up and idle. I was scared to death over there. It was cool. There's so much country with nobody in it and tons of fish. Just the place protects itself. Like, as soon as it's low enough to start sight fishing, you're pulling over rocks and ridges, and it's not oyster bars you're looking at. It's like rock ridges sticking out of the water. Like, it's oyster bars are soft, really, when you hit them. Those things are hard. So,
yeah,
you know, go slow, idle a lot.
Yeah, you know? All the guys over there in Homosassa are just like, they've just in their mind have mentally grasped that they're going to lose lower units. And it's almost like talking to them, it's like, it's not even the same fear that I think a lot of people have around the rest of the state.
No, here you just go faster and get out of whatever's going on, unless you're in the lower keys, there's some rock down there.
Mm-hmm.
But even Chuck Lilleski's benign now compared to Homosassa. Like, oyster bars literally are soft. You can hit them all day long, nothing really happens. Those rock ledges and ridges over there are no joke.
Yeah, for sure. With, you know, it's always interesting being with people too, who they guide the waters that they kind of grew up fishing on and cut their teeth on. But for you, have there been any places or destination trips that you feel like were really amazing and maybe gave you some sort of big takeaway?
The Bahamas are always super fun. I love bone fishing as much as anything, good bone fishing. But I had the opportunity to go to Cuba maybe 5 years ago or 6 years ago. And that was really cool. Just going back, it's going back in time, literally. It's the 50s, you know, on the water and on the land. There were so many mutton snappers in the finger channels that after a while, all we wanted to do was jig the finger channels for mutton snappers. Like, we didn't care about the tarpon and the permit and all the stuff around.
Yeah.
Because the mutton snapper fishing was so good. And they were on the flats too, somewhat.
Yeah, yeah. That's we saw some, you know, mutton snapper, you know, here and there.
Yeah.
Kind of driving around. It's a beautiful, really cool fish for sure.
Yeah. But just so that's how the Keys and Biscayne were for sure before, you know, overfished. Just all the channels had a million muttons. Like, you could just look down in Cuba floating over the channels and see the muttons scooting from every rock and sea fan. And, you know, they're smart too. You drift the channel once, you catch them. You drift it twice, you don't catch them. They're smart.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's pretty neat.
For somebody who maybe doesn't know much about the Everglades, what are some of those moments that happen or times of year things that you really live for?
I mean, it's always fun, nice to know that you're in the place at the right time and you're seeing something you're probably never going to see again. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, suck it up, because no matter how much you try to plan to find that again, you may not find it.
Yeah.
Whether it's a shrimp hatches, worm hatches, that's easier stuff to predict. But sometimes you just run into areas just full of fish. There's bait. It's full of low-hanging fruit, basically, yeah. You know. And just to have your way with them and, you know, leave them bite and just go do something else. But
any of those moments that like stick out to you and thinking back, like just you pull up somewhere and there's 100 snook somewhere or.
So one time just out of high school, my buddy had his grandparents had a place over in Englewood, Florida. Mm-hmm. And we were over there. We went wade fishing on this one flat by this one big bridge, whatever it was, before dark one night. And the whole flat erupted in exploding snook like an hour before dark. It was literally everywhere, exploding snook in every direction as far as you could see on this one flat. And that was being in the just luckily in the right place at the right time. But that's as good as something as you could just luck into.
Yeah.
You know, that was pretty neat to see that. And it didn't happen the next night. So.
And Englewood looks a lot different now probably than it did back then.
I haven't been back since, but I'm sure it does.
Yeah, don't go then.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
I know that you know, with trying to keep things really lightweight and really simple, what are some you know, kind of essential things that you want to take fishing tackle wise to make sure that you're ready for whatever? How do you keep it simple?
So basically you could just have a 3-inch paddle tail jig of whatever brand you like on a 1/8-ounce lead head and never fish anything else. Catch everything in the park every day, all day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's nice to throw topwater plugs and different things to get better bites or mm-hmm. appeal to different size fish. You know, flies, keep it pretty simple. I just have either black or white flies, or dark brown or white flies for the Everglades, more or less. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the muddy water, you want the fly to stand out.
Mm-hmm.
Bone fishing, all my flies are tan. It's the same fly, different weights, same fly. Just keep it simple.
Do you have, different rods rigged up for different scenarios at all time in the Everglades? Like, you pretty much always have a paddle tail on and just ready to pitch to something if you need to? I mean,
yeah, that's like a go-to, whether it's on a weedless worm hook or a jig head or mm-hmm. you know, it's low maintenance. Everybody you can just reel it in and fish bite it better than anything. You don't have to jig it and worry about retrieve and cadence. Just wind it in medium and hang on. And for the tarpon fishing, I've gotten away from treble hooks totally. It's, you break so many off, it's not fair to leave them in the fish.
Yeah,
you know, those big old fish. So you jump off a lot more, but I've gotten away from treble hooks for tarpon fishing 100%. You know, I feel like that's fair to them.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's been, you know, I didn't grow up tarpon fishing.
Yeah.
And so that's just been something that it seems to be like at a place where it's becoming pretty much the norm.
Yeah. And the plastics have come along so much lately that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They're great.
For you, let's create a scenario here. Let's say that you've had a day on the water where everything's changed. Like just one of those days where you had a rough day on the water. You're coming back home. You're trying to get ready for day two. How are you trying to come up with a game plan and set yourself up to bounce back?
Well, you know, you always, when you start the fishing day, you always have a preconceived notion of what you might do, mm-hmm. you know, or how things might look. But sometimes you get there and everything's different. The wind's not like you thought, or there's a huge rain cloud all to the east and you got to go to the west and figure out a whole new game plan. So mm-hmm. you kind of always want to have something else in the back of your head, or even while you're in good fishing, you got to be thinking, what's my next move? Because it's going to be the next move sooner or later. You want to be stumbling around looking, you know, like, you know what's going on. So but it's always good to have a game plan, but be flexible in a second because things change quick, you know, especially if you're sight fishing with light or this or that. Or
do you find yourself, like, if you had to rate yourself on a spectrum, do you feel like you will pull out of a situation a little faster than most people, or do you give it a little more time? Because that's one of the things that's interesting about the Everglades too. If you're going way back in somewhere, for instance, and it's not going on, it's a big commitment sometimes to get out. Like,
I mean, I usually know in a second, as soon as you shut the boat, look around, you either know it's game on or not. Just the feel you get while you know what you're seeing in the water immediately, mm-hmm. or how it feels or smells, or you know, you kind of get a feeling. If you start pulling and you're not seeing things moving around like you thought, you're like, oh man, and you get it pretty quick. You know, pretty mm-hmm. quick usually, just because doing it so much and seeing the same areas for so many hundreds of days.
Yeah.
You just get a pretty quick intuition. And, you know, I do pull some stuff out if I really believe they're there somewhere. They're just, I'm not quite in the right zone, or mm-hmm. usually you're probably not. Like, you know, they're usually always, you're always within a mile of a pile, I say. Like, they're there somewhere. You just, not where you thought they were. You know, you could be an 1/8 of a mile from a lot of fish and you don't know it,
mm-hmm.
unless they're showing somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was curious too, like, for you, when you look back at your life, what do you feel like was most shaping in your life as a guide?
I gotta think about this one for a minute. Just you know, trying to network with, you know, a few people that are key and you can trust. And it also helps in work's bouncing around, because you need, you know, enough buddies that when work's bouncing around, it comes your way too when they're booked, and then you give it back to them when they're you know, when you're booked. Yeah, just having a you know, a good work ethic, but still keeping it all in perspective. Like, there's some people that fish sun up to sun down, and that's very cool if they want to do it, but that's not me and sustainable, what I feel like is sustainable for life. So work as hard as you can for those hours you're in the boat and give it all and come in, you know. You know,
what's the story behind, I know you got in a boat accident this past year. Could you give us the story on that?
All right. So, I'll tell you a good boat accident story. So, a good buddy of mine, he's a client also, Julian Robertson. We were a long time ago pulling around in the no motor zone, and we pulled right. I was pulling fast to get across the bay, and we pulled right into a crocodile laying on the bottom that we never saw. And so the crocodile stood up, the boat was thrown in the air, the crocodile bit the boat and shook it. He put three holes in the wood hull.
Wow.
Ripped the rub rail down in the bow, and my buddy Julian fell out of the boat and on the tail side of the crocodile.
Holy cow.
We had T-boned him and he fell onto the tail, and his legs got stuck in the mud. So he's trying to pull himself in, the crocodile shaking the boat and hissing. I'm on the pulling tower just trying to hang on.
Yeah.
So Julian finally frees his legs, jumps in the boat, and tries to run back where I'm at and get on the pulling tower with me. And that's just, you know. So anyways, I backed up and the croc was pissed and we were a little shaken up, but everything worked out. We pulled over to the bank and inspected the boat, and we weren't going to sink, so we just kept fishing.
Wow. Do you have like photos of the teeth marks or anything?
I do. I've got them in an album somewhere. Yep.
Yeah. If you can find those, I'll put those in the blog post. That'd be a really cool addition. But
So there's never been a documented croc attack in the state of Florida at that time. And I think there's only one now. It was in a residential canal in Miami just a year or two ago. So anyway, that wasn't a documented attack, and it wasn't really a malicious attack, but we did get bit.
Yeah. Yeah, know? For sure. I mean, what are the chances to just pull right over on
top of
him?
I mean, we were pulling fast, and we T-boned him. He was mad, you know. Yeah, wedged him to the bottom in a foot and a half of water, you know.
Are there any other great stories you have of, like, certain memorable moments when you think back to the Everglades? Like, if we were going to create a five-minute, you know, video of Brian's life, and you could somehow go back and just capture that moment, what's, you know, for you, like, the most special moment you've had out there?
Yeah, just, I don't know about the most special, but just, you know, tons of times with friends out there, and then times with good clients, and sometimes it's just getting that fish in there where it's just clicking, and it's, you know, it's coming to you easy, and it's magical, and then lots of times you grind, but I'm trying to think of one magical moment, but it all kind of blends together, just good times with lots of friends and lots of fish, and it's just a cool place to have down there, and knowing you have that there, you know, and it's going to be, you know, the way it is hopefully for a long time, and people are protecting it, and that's nice to know.
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot of great conversation around conservation with the Everglades, and we've seen a lot of momentum, and we've seen social media and the internet and videos and photography used really well to promote that special place that I think a lot of people just, it's an intimidating place, and so you have a lot of Floridians who've never been there, never fished there, never done anything around it. So I mean, I think that's one of the things too that's been really cool with different groups like Captains for Clean Water and other groups that kind of focus on conservation, is helping also just engage people who maybe haven't had the chance to see that yet.
Yeah for sure. Education, you know, and the next generation coming, they got to be into it or they're not going to protect it. That's important. And you know, most of the state's losing grass, and we're actually growing grass right now, so that's a good sign. You know, and we're not getting the red tide so bad down there, and our fish populations are way up, so we're doing good. We just got to keep the ball rolling and keep, you know, getting more water to come down and getting the clean water, and you know, try. And around the state though, it's all one big ball of wax. We need to grow grass back and all these other estuaries, and then there's so many people living around them, and so much, you know, exposure to boats and boat noise. There's got to be, you know, so many people move to Florida every day. You know, like I just heard the piece in the Mayaca River, they're running airboat tours up and down there now, waking the banks all day long every day, making noise, and that's not good for anything.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all the estuaries have their deal, but the Everglades are doing good right now, as good as any of them are that I know of.
Yeah, it's definitely concerning, like, there's the number of people moving to Florida, and just, you know, will we do things correctly with population growth and everything? I was curious too. So one of the things that, you know, a mutual friend, Harry, he talks about being a great angler is kind of like a pie. It's made up of a bunch of little pieces, right. And you got, you know, like having good eyes, and you got your casting, and you got, you know, all these little pieces to a pie. Mm-hmm. Like when you think about somebody being a great angler to you, what are some of those pieces that maybe get overlooked?
Yeah. Like, you know, maybe using different tackle types, like spin fishing, a lot of, you know, plug fishing. Plug fishing is kind of like a dying art. Not a lot of guys are doing it, especially in the salt. And that was a huge thing, especially in South Florida, the Met tournament, all that stuff. And different tackle, different, seeing different areas of the world and being just well-rounded and, you know, having fished offshore, having fished in backcountry puddles in the freshwater here and there. And maybe just, you know, being well-rounded and traveled, maybe seasoned, you know, a lot of, you know, getting out there and really doing it yourself and learning, you know, some stuff.
If you could go back to yourself, and this is my last question, but if you could go back to yourself when you were a kid and you were putting in the John boat in the Everglades and you could give yourself some advice, life advice.
Yeah.
What would that be?
Yeah. Nothing's either as good or as bad as you think it is, you know, just put more money in the market earlier. So I wouldn't be pulling anymore. Yeah. No, but, God dang, just have fun, man. Don't take everything so serious. You know, life's always going to kind of, you know, go up and down. Just, you know, it's going to, if you're down, it's going to be good again. Just, you know, just take it easy, have a good time, and, you know, it goes by pretty quick. Yeah, and definitely take enough time for yourself. You get caught up working a lot, you need some time for yourself too, you know. You got to always be the angler. Even, you know, no matter how much you guide, you still got to, like, want to be the angler. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's, yeah, and still, I mean, you hear a lot of guys talk about having a hard time fighting to still love it, you know, just because it's their job. And
right, you hear it. Yep. I'm not, at first I didn't want to guide because I thought it might ruin what I really like to do, but it hasn't. As soon as I'm off for 2 days, 3 days, I want to go fishing, you know. So, you know, and I still take a few casts on the boat when the guys are eating lunch or over their head. Catch enough fish. I probably don't personally need to ever reel in a big tarpon again, but I love guiding to them.
Yeah.
You know, a whole lot. So.
Well, I really appreciate just allowing us to come over and hang out today, and you got a beautiful home, and
thank you.
Really appreciate all the insight and time that you shared today.
Yeah, thanks for choosing me and having me, and it's been great doing this. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to the Captain's Collective. Please help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and sharing this podcast. We hope that you enjoy. This is the Captain's Collective.